Welcome to JBJS Ortho Corps. Listen as members of the ortho community, residents, surgeons, educators, staff, and patients share their stories about the experiences and people most important in their lives and the lessons they learned along the way. Ortho Corps is an audio archive inspired by StoryCorps and independently organized by the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
Hi, I'm Paul Sponseller, Professor of Pediatric Orthopedics at Johns Hopkins, and also the Pediatric Deputy Editor of the JBJS. And I'm here to interview Dr. Bruce Fredrickson about a most unusual population study on spondylolisthesis and spondylolysis, the backstory. Dr. Fredrickson was Professor of Spine Surgery at Syracuse University, now retired. The study was published in 1984 in JBJS, entitled The Natural History of Spondylolysis and Listhesis. It's been cited almost 1,100 times. And up until that time, there was no reliable population data on the development of the condition. And this study accomplished that, but it had an unusual participation by the community in Sarah, Pennsylvania. Our story starts at the Guthrie Clinic in Sarah, Pennsylvania. Sarah is a borough in the Lehigh Valley in the northern part of Bradford County, Pennsylvania, just below the New York state line. It's not a particular academic community. It had a population of 5,400 in the 2020 census. And there was an unusual degree of buy-in from the community, and this is what they did. They had 500 first grade children in the mid-1950s who were participating, and each underwent an AP lateral and oblique x-rays of the lumbar spine. And these kids were brought back again at ages 10 to 12, 15 to 16, and at graduation. And what they found was that the incidence of spondylolysis at age 6 was already 4.4%, but it only increased to 6% in adulthood. They also did three ancillary studies. They took the kids who had a pars defect and x-rayed their family to look at the genetic aspects of the condition. And they also x-rayed 500 normal neonates from the community to see if there was evidence of the condition at birth. And then as a check on the genetics of the first ancillary study, they took 32 kids delivered at the same OB unit and x-rayed their family members to see about the prevalence within the families as well. They then followed this up 45 years later with support from NASS and looked at these people again. No subject with a pars defect was lost to follow-up. They then administered an MRI, a back pain questionnaire, and an SF-36 survey. They found the progression of spondylolisthesis slowed with each decade and that there was no association of slip progression with low back pain. And in fact, no statistically significant difference between the study population SF-36 scores and the general population. And this has been cited almost 500 times. So I just wanted to discuss these two remarkable population studies and how they came about. The initial study was, I think, masterminded by Dr. Daniel Baker in Pennsylvania. So Bruce, can you give us a little bit of background about Dr. Daniel Baker? He must have been very scientifically oriented to organize such a rigorous study.
I met Dan when I started my internship at the Guthrie Clinic, which is in 1972. Dan was at that time was head of orthopedics. Back in the 50s, they had an orthopedic residency for a period of time, which was discontinued when the academy revamped their residency requirements. During that time, specifically 55, they developed that thoughts and initiated the study that you're talking about. My understanding from Dan at the time was that the school actually was across a large field, now a parking lot at the Guthrie Clinic, and they brought the kids over actually in a hearse because he was friendly with the local coroner, and that was the method of transportation. So as the study states in the paper, it took them 3 years to get enough children to participate in this study. They had pretty much 100% agreement from the local community. I don't think there was many that said no. They did an awful lot of x-rays on these kids, including tomography, which is a large dose of radiation. But they carried it on through all the years as stated. I picked it up later in the 70s when I was in the orthopedic residency in Syracuse. And during our next to last year, at that time, it was the second year of residency. We had an opportunity for 3 months to do research. And so I elected to go back down to SAIR, where I had spent my first 2 years of training postgraduate. And I was the one at that point then started trying to find all these patients again, which was reported in the first study.
Do you know how Dr. Baker became so interested in this topic?
He always quotes that article by Freiberg as the one that initially got his interest up. Exactly what transpired during that time, there was another Dr. McCulloch who's cited also in that first paper, and he was a resident at the time. So he did a lot of the grunt work, so to speak, getting the kids in, doing all the x-rays. There was one x-ray technician during this time that actually I worked with into the 70s and even sometimes in the 80s, and she did all the x-rays.
Mm-hmm. And so I assume he did the work, but he just never got around to writing it up. And how did you learn about this remarkable patient population and database?
Well, again, I was an intern and then a first-year surgical resident there. So I, in talking with him during that time frame, I heard about the study. He did present it at the Academy shortly after completing the initial 500. So I can't remember exactly whether that was, I think it was sometime in the late 50s. And I did at one point have some of those slides, but they've all been lost for over the years.
Can you tell us a little bit about the community and how perhaps that influenced their willingness to participate in such a large scale?
Well, as you mentioned, the Guthrie Clinic was started by Dr. Guthrie, who trained at the Mayo Clinic, and he came to SAIR and was offered the position as being head of the Lehigh Valley Medical Department, and started a clinic. And his goal was to mimic the Mayo philosophy, which he did over the next decades. Dan was rather academically orientated. He did a lot of other things besides the spondylus study. They actually made plates out of methyl methacrylate, molding them to various bones, and use those with screws, obviously, to fix fractures. He did a lot of work on hip replacements at that time. They were basically the Judae. He loved to tell a story about doing a similar prosthesis, but he made it out of granite. And it worked really well. And he actually took the patient to the Academy meeting in Chicago, at which point he put him through all of the usual things. And then he couldn't find the patient afterwards. Turns out that the granite had fragmented right during the show, so to speak. And he had to take him back and pull all the pieces out of his hip. So, but he did. He was an interesting person, very academically orientated.
Did he tell you anything about what he did to get the school system to buy in and the kids to participate and arrange for this to happen?
Not specifically, other than the Guthrie Clinic is a major employer in the area. It's a very small community. Everybody literally knows everybody. And I think it was just a matter of word of mouth and friends, and everyone was happy to help out.
So, Bruce, do you happen to know who paid for the study expenses? I assume that maybe his practice absorbed the cost as we
often say. The Guthrie Clinic paid for it. They do have a research foundation. When it got to later stages, the North American Spine Society paid for the later part of the studies.
Mm-hmm. And nowadays we have IRBs for everything. Do you know what the structure of human subject approval was at that point? Was it local hospitals or some other entity? And did he kind of run it through something like that?
It was the local hospital approval, exactly. I don't think they had an IRB board specifically, but he did go through some type of local hospital committee.
In the process of following this up, did you happen to hear of any reluctance or resistance among patients to participate or to follow up in this study?
Most of them were quite cooperative. Bill Butler, who's a neurosurgeon in Harrisburg, did the last big follow-up of the 30 patients, and he found everybody, literally. He went to one patient's house, and she would not cooperate. That was the only one that would not.
That's amazing. Yeah. And do you know how John Lubicki and Hanson Yuan got involved in this study?
They're my partners at the time, so we kind of worked together on it.
Yeah. So I like to quote this study all the time, and it's really influenced my understanding of the PARS defect and how it affects people's lives and how we should treat it. So I rely on this all the time. What do you think this study tells us about modern human subjects research and the potential value for these cross-sectional studies and compared to how it was done back then?
I think it'd be extremely difficult to do this study today. I don't think you could do it.
Yeah, impossible. So, yeah, I think it's an important project. And the follow-up study that was the idea of Dr. Butler, and it was supported by NASS, is that right?
No, it's actually my study. Bill came up as a research fellow for 6 months and worked with us. And he heard what I had, and he became really interested in it. And then he ended up actually, as I said, doing a lot of the actual grunt work on it.
Yeah, I think that was very influential as well. So any further thoughts on this topic?
Well, you know, back then when we brought the article out in the 80s, it met with a lot of skepticism, and there's a lot of people in the various societies who actually tried to prevent its publication. And it was interesting. There was also some significant editorials in the JBJS at that time when it was published.
Good. Well, I really appreciate your willingness to give us the backstory on this remarkable piece of patient research, because I've often wondered about it, and I'm glad I really get the chance to ask you about it in person and pass it on to posterity. So I really appreciate your willingness to come back and tell us about this in more detail.
Well, thanks for the interest.
Yes, thank you. Have a great day.
You too now.